Good evening. Welcome to our 20 Lessons You Need to Learn to Be an Informed Jew podcast. We are up to, we're going to do an important one tonight. We're going to talk about kosher. And kosher, one of the defining features of an observant Jew is the Jew's diet, keeping kosher. And it's really been that way for over 3,000 years. It's been a hallmark of Jewish identity, is keeping kosher, a very specific type of diet. The word kosher means proper or acceptable, and it's actually informally entered the English language with that meaning. Most people know the word kosher. So what I want to do tonight is provide the details of keeping kosher, or at least many of the details, probably the most salient, the most most important details. And then the meaning behind the details of the Jewish dietary code, this idea of keeping kosher. So kosher laws have their origins in the Torah, the five books of Moses. They're detailed in the Talmud and discussed at length in the codes of Jewish law. And their meaning is discussed at length as well in Jewish philosophy and commentary. So what I want to start with is the biblically prohibited foods. Now this is some, I'm going to start with some of the most well-known stuff. Right, the animals that Jews are allowed to eat and not allowed to eat according to the kosher laws. So everyone knows where Jews don't eat pig, right? Jews don't eat bacon, Jews don't eat pork. But what exactly are the parameters of which animals we're allowed to eat and which we are not? So the Torah tells us that in order to be in a kosher animal, you need to have two specific identifying characteristics. Number one, the animal needs to chew their cud. They have to be ruminants. And number two, they have to have split hooves. What exactly is chewing their cud? Well, we're not going to try to, we're not going to get too scientific, but basically the idea is that a ruminant or a cud-chewing animal has four sections to their stomach. First, it eats and it barely chews the food at all. The food enters the first compartment where it's broken down. In the second compartment, the food mixes with saliva and becomes what's called cud. That cud comes back up and the animal chews it to further break it down. Then it enters the third compartment where the water is absorbed out of the food. And finally, it enters the last section, which digests the food, much like a human being's stomach. And then split hooves are split hooves, literally hooves that are split into two separate hooves. So let's talk a little bit about the details of what it means to keep kosher. And then we're going to come back to talk about, spend a little bit of time on talking about the meaning behind an animal needing to have split hooves and chew its cud in order for it to be kosher. Let's go to birds, though. The Torah lists, so this one, there's no identifying features for birds in order to be kosher. The Torah lists 24 non-kosher bird species, generally predatory and scavenging birds. Examples of kosher birds are the species of chickens and ducks and geese and turkeys and even pigeons. Interestingly, I was wondering to myself if any birds that are actually not kosher are commonly eaten. So I wrote into Google the top 10 birds that are eaten worldwide. And basically on every single list I saw, the top 10 birds eaten worldwide were only kosher birds. That's just an interesting piece of trivia. So I want to first, this is the first idea of kosher that I want to introduce. Talking about these birds, the kosher birds and the non-kosher birds. We all know that what we eat impacts us. It impacts us physically, for sure. Some things are better for our bodies and some things are worse for our bodies. And food also impacts on our emotions and on our mental faculties as well. We can feel lethargic. We can feel just gross. We can feel tired when we go ahead and eat. And those are more physical things, but certainly also food impacts on our emotions and our mental faculties as well. In fact, so much research has shown that diet has a tremendous impact on mental health. And the connection between what we eat, what we consume, and our well-being is becoming more and more well-known, and people are focusing more and more on it every single day. Because human beings are holistic beings, and everything is interdependent, our mental health, our emotional health, our physical health. And all of that, therefore, will then be impacted by everything, including by what we eat. Well, Judaism adds one extra aspect to that holistic approach or that holistic makeup of the human being and says that there's one more part to it. There's the mind, there's the body, and then there is also the soul or the spirit. And kosher speaks directly to that. Kosher food is spiritual health food, which in turn impacts on the entire holistic being, because our perspective, the Jewish perspective, as well as the perspective of many, is that the holistic human being has an interconnected relationship between body, mind, and spirit, and kosher speaks directly to that. As we take a look at the world and look at it as more of a holistic essence, as more of a holistic makeup, then we can also understand that the physical and spiritual of any created being will come together, will fuse. And we could even perhaps say that the physical of the world manifests the spiritual makeup of every single being. Non-kosher birds, birds that are prohibited by the Torah, are by and large predators, are by and large birds that eat other animals. But that's not really what differentiates between kosher birds and non-kosher birds. What the medieval Jewish sages tell us is that what is important is not what the bird eats, but rather how it eats it. A bird, in order to be defined as a non-kosher bird, according to Jewish law, it must claw its prey to death or eat it in some other cruel fashion. This is why duck, for example, a duck with its wide bill and webbed feet, it's still considered kosher, even though some ducks subsist largely on a diet of fish and insects. The physical, so what we're seeing though, is that it's the physical makeup of the bird. A bird that claws its prey to death, a bird that eats it in some other cruel fashion, those are the ones that are non-kosher. Almost to point towards this direction of the physical nature of non-kosher birds reflects a certain spiritual makeup that is not healthy on a holistic level for a Jew to consume, no different than anything else that we are told not to consume. But I think the bird, and specifically this cruel nature of a bird, this predatory nature, this clawing nature of the bird, shows us this in a very interesting and salient fashion. So let's go back though. So that's the first idea of kosher that I wanted to mention tonight. It's this idea of there being this holistic human being that includes the spiritual side as well, and kosher would almost be the spiritual health food, which is in turn healthy for the entire being of the human. Now, it's not enough. Let's go back to details though about what it means to keep kosher. It's not enough to make sure that the animal that you are eating is a kosher species, but it also needs to be slaughtered in a very specific way, both when it comes to mammals and when it comes to birds. We're talking about the sharpest knife you can find, very specific type of knife, and a very specific slaughter that is completely painless, That specific slaughter is called in Hebrew shechita. Shechita, that's a word to remember. And it's done by somebody who has trained for a very long time to do this very painless type of slaughter, and that person is called, the person that does shechita, who is trained to do so, who is qualified to do so, is called a shochet. He is the ritual slaughterer. There are other requirements that we'll talk about in a moment when it comes to the kosher laws, but let's digress to talk about another animal family, and that is the fish. What makes a fish kosher? So for that, we have fins and scales. A fish, in order for it to be kosher, requires fins and scales. What are some examples of that? Salmon, tuna, pike, flounder, carp, and herring, of course, are all kosher. Catfish, swordfish, lobster, shellfish, crabs, those are not kosher. Now, what's the idea of fins and scales? So just one quick thought that I wanted to share. The commentaries say that fish swimming through the water teach us, the kosher fish swimming through the water teach us what our swimming as a Jewish people, what our swimming as a Jewish individual, what our journey through life and through history should look like. The scales are a thickened layer of skin that's designed to protect the fish, to ward off external dangers such as sudden changes in temperature and water pressure or other attacking fish. So scales are the armor that protect the body of the fish. Fins, which are wing-like organs, propel the fish forward. They allow the fish to move along in the water, to make progress, to advance to great distances, to journey in new directions, and to remain, and not to remain in one space and one location. And I think that what the idea of the fish possessing both fins and scales and what it teaches us about being a Jewish in our world and throughout history is something very important. We need to have our scales. What does that mean? We need to make sure that we have a we are able to resist outside influences and limit our interactions with those things that go against our values, Judaism's essential values. That's the scales, that thick skin that shields us. However, and where many seem to make the mistake, we cannot live sheltered lives, or then we would not be fulfilling our mission as the Jewish people. So of course, we also need to have fins. What are fins? The part that allows us to advance forward, allows us to become part of the modern conversation, allows us to advance with history, within history, to become progressive, to join the larger culture. We have to become a fusion, a synthesis of both the fins and scales, and that is what the kosher fish teaches us about. Okay, let's now talk about insects, reptiles, and amphibians. Insects, reptiles, and amphibians are not kosher, except for certain types of locust or grasshoppers, on which most communities lack a clear tradition of which exactly are kosher, but there certainly are some kosher locusts and grasshoppers. Now, you may say, besides perhaps for frog legs, insects are not really something that we want to eat, although now we know that there's grasshopper protein that's becoming more popular. But in general, insects are not something that we're very interested in eating unless we are on a game show where we're going to be paid a lot of money for eating a lot of spiders. But the truth is that it does have huge repercussions, because we all eat bugs all the time in our produce. Leaves, lettuce. Lettuce is full of bugs. And in order to be kosher lettuce, in order to be a kosher leafy green, it needs to be checked thoroughly for bugs in a very specific way, which means that if you keep kosher, you are eating extremely clean and bug-free lettuce. When a kosher observant Jew buys lettuce, they either have to buy one that has kosher certification that tells you that it was checked for bugs, or they have to go through their own checking process at home. Let's talk about products that come from animals. So let's talk about milk and eggs. The rule of thumb is that what comes from a kosher animal is kosher. What comes from a non-kosher animal is not kosher. One exception to this rule is honey. A bee is not kosher, but the honey that comes from the bee is. Now, let's go back to some other requirements. Even after you have a kosher species of animal, and it was slaughtered correctly, the birds and the mammals that need to be slaughtered, there are still some very important things to remember in order to ensure that an animal is kosher. Number one is it cannot be a trefa, trefa in Hebrew, which means torn, but it's a reference to being injured. An animal with a significant defect or injury, such as a fractured bone or a particular type of lung adhesion, that is not going to be kosher, even if you slaughtered it, you did the ritual slaughter, you shechted it in the proper way. And really, this law of it not being allowed to be injured is really to ensure that observant Jews treat animals in the most humane way as possible, because it's very common when it comes to farm-grown animals, grown specifically for slaughter, that they are not treated in a very humane way. They're raised with nowhere to move. They're all on top of each other, so on and so forth. And these types of this way of raising animals without keeping in mind humane treatment will very easily bring them to be injured, specifically in the ways that would make them a trefa and therefore not kosher. So what we're really saying is that if an animal has sustained that type of injury, it's not kosher. So you better treat that animal well up until you slaughter it for food. So that's a very interesting idea. Another important concept when it comes to kosher, blood. The blood of kosher mammals and fowls may not, or birds, are not allowed to be eaten. And it actually has to be removed through salting with special procedures for the liver. So basically, within 72 hours of slaughter, all blood is drained from the meat by a special soaking and salting process. We'll talk a little bit more about the prohibition against eating blood a little bit later on. I just want to mention a couple of other important points when it comes to an animal being kosher, and what we're allowed to eat even from a kosher animal. So number one, particular types of fat of the abdominal fat of cattle, goats, and sheep, that has to be removed. It's not allowed to be eaten. That has to be removed. A very important one is that we're not allowed to eat the sciatic nerve, which is in the thigh of the animal. And this is why, at least in the North America, that unless you're talking about a very high-end kosher restaurant, you don't usually see filet mignon. Because filet mignon is kosher. That cut of meat is kosher. However, since the meat is very close to the sciatic nerve, which is the sinew, as I explained, which is in the animal's leg that the Torah forbids us to eat, you need to have a very skilled person to separate the sciatic nerve from the meat itself. And in the United States, what we end up doing, it makes more economical sense, financial sense, is we sell the hind portions, which is where the filet mignon is, we sell the hind portions of the animal to non-Jewish or non-kosher butchers. They don't have to deal with this intricate process of removing the sciatic nerve. So those cuts, at least in North America, are not readily available. I want to quickly share with you the background as to why we're not allowed to eat the sciatic nerve, because I think it shows us an important facet of Jewish ritual, and specifically also kosher as well, that in Judaism, there are some of our rituals are there to act as symbolic reminders of something, to make sure that we don't forget something, to make sure that we internalize something. And the sciatic nerve, or not eating the sciatic nerve, is exactly that. Many, many years ago, thousands of years ago, going back to the early patriarchs and matriarchs of the Jewish people, the last of the three major patriarchs was Jacob. Jacob fought with an angel prior to his meeting, his reunion, after many, many years with his brother Esav, who had sworn to kill him many years earlier. When the angel that he was fighting with realized that he could not prevail over Yaakov or Jacob, he struck Yaakov's hip, dislocating his thigh bone from the hip socket and leaving him with a limp. And in consequence, the Torah says, therefore the Jewish people must not eat the displaced sinew of Jacob's, the sciatic nerve, to this very day, because it was that was displaced by the angel. And that story has a lot of significance. We're not going to get into it right now. That's when Jacob gets the name Israel, which becomes the name of the Jewish people forever and ever. So that we're never to forget it, we're not allowed to eat that part of the animal. Just so you know, in Israel, another reason to go and visit Israel, in Israel, there is a very small market for non-kosher meat. So there would be very few people, there would be very few companies to sell the hind portions to. So in Israel, the entire animal is kosher. The gid hanasheh, the sciatic nerve, is removed. And therefore, filet mignon is much more readily available in Israel, which again is another reason to go and visit. Another important part of keeping kosher is, and what's also interesting, in Judaism, we believe that, you know, that there are 613 mitzvot. There are 613 commandments commanded to the Jewish people. And then for the entire world, there are seven basic laws, that basic categories of law. And one of them is humane treatment of animals, specifically not being allowed to eat aver min hachai. The limb of a living animal, cut off of a living animal, is not kosher. That is still done in some areas of the world, unfortunately. That, of course, is not kosher, again, because we are enjoined to treat animals in the most humane way possible. Just a couple of other details before we get to some more of the meaning behind keeping kosher. Untithed food. Produce of the land of Israel, you need to tithe. You need to separate some from the produce, and then that was given to the Kohanim, the priests of the Holy Temple, the Levites, the poor, and that still exists today. So therefore, produce from Israel can only be purchased if it comes with a reliable kosher certificate saying that the appropriate tithes have been taken off. Another interesting one is wine that it may have been dedicated to idolatrous practices. Yayin nesech, it's called in Hebrew. Nesech is libation. That may have been dedicated to idolatrous practices is not allowed to be drunk, and we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. And then we get to the last detail I want to talk about right now, and that is mixtures of meat and milk. We're not allowed to have double bacon cheeseburgers. We're not even allowed to have a cheeseburger with milk and meat. Now, this law is derived from a verse. The verse says, Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. One shall not cook a goat in its mother's milk. Milk represents the mother. The meat represents the child. You're not allowed to cook the meat in its mother's milk. It says this verse three times, and from there we learn that there are three prohibitions when it comes to milk products and meat products together. What are they? The prohibitions are you're not allowed to eat a mixture of dairy and meat. You are not allowed to cook a mixture of dairy and meat, and you're also not allowed to get a benefit from dairy and meat, from a mixture of dairy and meat. So for instance, you are not allowed to make a cheeseburger. You're not allowed to cook a cheeseburger. You're not allowed to eat a cheeseburger, but you also are not allowed to sell a cheeseburger to somebody that doesn't keep kosher, which is not true when it comes, for instance, to a pork chop. There's no problem with selling a pork chop to somebody that is not Jewish. So milk and meat are never combined. Separate utensils are used for each of them, and a waiting period is observed between eating them as well. The idea being that, again, a lot of the rituals in Judaism are there for us to remember things or to become sensitive or to make sure that we remain sensitive to something. What does the verse tell us? You're not allowed to cook a goat in its mother's milk, speaking directly to this should be something that is abominable to us. It should be disgusting to us to cook a goat in its mother's milk because it would be such an infringement. It would be such a blow to the deepest relationship that exists between a parent and a child. To eat them together we need to be sensitive to that. And in order to maintain the highest level of sensitivity to that, we are told we are not allowed to have milk and meat together. Milk representative of a mother, of the parent. The goat representative of the child, we are never allowed to bring that type of, we need to be extra careful and extra sensitive to that type of suffering. So, because of this, for a kosher observing Jew, foods are divided into three categories. Meat, fleishigs in Yiddish, and this includes meat, bones of animals, soups or gravies made with them, and any food containing even a small quantity of meat or of the above. Then you have dairy or milchigs in Yiddish, and that includes all milk products, cream, butter, cheese, and any food containing even a small quantity of the above. And then you have the pariv foods in Yiddish. Pariv means pariv, neither meat nor dairy. Eggs are actually pariv, interestingly enough, as are all fruits, vegetables, and grains. Pariv foods can be mixed with and eaten together with either meat or dairy. And fish, interestingly enough, are pariv as well. Hence, lox, bagels, and cream cheese. Now, just some examples, quick examples of how far-reaching the laws of kosher go when we talk about not being allowed to eat something that is not kosher. If you have a loaf of bread baked in a pan that's smeared with shortening that contains even a small percentage, for instance, of pig fat, let's say, or you have a dish prepared, a dish that is completely kosher ingredients prepared in a restaurant kitchen that is not a kosher kitchen. In all these cases, out of both of those cases, you have non-kosher, those are not considered kosher dishes any longer. And so too, when it comes to separate utensils for meat and milk, you have to make sure that those meat and milk utensils are separate. And therefore, you cannot cook a lasagna on a dairy lasagna in a pan that is used to cook a meat lasagna. So the laws of kosher are expansive. But once you get it, you get it. But they certainly have many details. So this means enough. It's not only enough to buy foods with kosher ingredients. The kitchen has to be kosher, which means that all cooking utensils and food preparation surfaces are used exclusively for kosher food. And that separate pots and cutlery and dishes are used for meat and dairy. Okay. Before we go on, I just want to make sure that we have 10 terms down pat, and then we can go on to talk more about the meaning behind the laws of kosher. So word number one is kosher, which is the catch-all term that refers to all that is fit to be consumed or to be used together with kosher food. The second word I want to point out is treif. Treif literally means torn, and it refers specifically to an animal that met an unnatural death other than ritual slaughter, which is, of course, not kosher. But we use the treif now to refer to any, the word treif, to refer to anything that is not kosher. The word pariv, which is the in-between foods, which is neither meat nor dairy. Fleishig, which is Yiddish, which means meaty. Milchigs, which is Yiddish, that means dairy. An interesting one that I think is important to know, we just finished the holiday of Pesach, is Pesachdik. Since Passover, or Pesach, has its own set of rules, food, and dishes that conform to the Passover standards, that is all referred to as Pesachdik. You have made your kitchen Pesachdik, ready to be used for Pesach cooking. Another important word to know, besides for kosher, this sounds like kosher, but it's kasher. Kasher is a verb, and it's the act of making something kosher. So it's the act of salting meat. You kasher the meat, you salt it, you extract the blood. If a dish that you have is not a kosher utensil, let's say it was used for milk and meat once, then there's ways to kasher it. There's ways to make it kosher by applying certain types of heat. Okay. Another one that's very interesting that is important to know is the Yiddish word glatt. Glatt kosher. Glatt literally means smooth. And it refers to an animal whose lungs have been found to be superbly healthy and free of any adhesions. This is a higher standard of kosher. And because it's a higher standard of kosher, the word glatt, kosher, has come to refer to food that is kosher according to the highest standards. And then the last word I want to make sure that we remember is shechita, which is that specific type of ritual slaughter. And the one that does that slaughter is a shochet, a ritual slaughterer, and those are Hebrew words. Okay, at the end of this talk, at the end of this discussion, I want to talk about kosher certification, but let's get to that at the end. And now let's talk about the meaning behind kashrut for a little bit. I think the first thing I want to point out is the idea, one thing I already pointed out is the holistic nature of the human being, and kosher feeds in directly to that, because the Jewish view and many's view, not just Judaism's view of holistic human being, includes a spiritual facet as well. But I want to talk about discipline. I find that one of the most important traits of a human being that differentiates between somebody that is successful in life and someone is not successful in life, at family, at relationships, whatever it is being a disciplined person, somebody that has control over themselves. And one of the best ways to make that happen is this idea of kosher. I think about going into a supermarket with my kids. And as kids are, they're asking for every candy that they see. And I'll say, no, 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 no. And then I'll say, but that's not kosher. And then they will stop asking for that candy. Because what kosher does, and it's something that comes up on a constant basis because we eat all the time, it brings real discipline into our lives from a very young age, if we keep kosher when we're very young. And it flows forth from there to our entire lives, allowing us to become more disciplined human beings. A second idea is the humane treatment of animals. It's very clear that kashrut, one facet of kashrut is the humane treatment of animals, the way we slaughter, the way we treat our animals prior to slaughter, hence an injured animal isn't kosher, not cutting off the limb of a living animal, so on and so forth. And I think there are some other profound lessons in the concept of kashrut. One of the most profound, and this is something that I think makes Judaism very special and very unique, is that kashrut reminds us every single day that Jewish spirituality is inseparable from what one might term the physical. It teaches us that Jewish spiritual practice is about taking the most ordinary of experiences in all aspects of our lives and transforming them into moments of deep spiritual meaning, deep meanings of connection. That's what the laws of kosher are. It's a Jewish spiritual discipline that is rooted in the concrete choices and details of daily life that otherwise would be thought of as very mundane. It's eating, very mundane. But that's what Judaism is all about, and that's exactly what it teaches us. It teaches us that spirituality is about far more than what we do in synagogues and on holidays. It extends into every area of our lives every single day. The spiritual realm encompasses all of our lives, every part of our lives. And as Jews, we don't look at the physical as something to spurn, but instead we look at the physical as something special, as something that can be used as a vehicle for great meaning, for great spiritual meaning and great spiritual connection. And I think that's a beautiful concept. I think that's beautifully taught to us through the laws of kosher. But those are all about kosher in general, this idea that we have a specific body of discipline around our eating. But now what I want to talk about is specific details of the kosher diet, and that is kosher animals. Chewing its cud and having split hooves, right? That seems like, where in the world did something like that come from? So early on, some of the medieval sages, so you have Maimonides, one of the most important Jewish sages in history. In his work, in his seminal work on philosophy, Guide to the Perplexed, he explains that the dietary laws, specifically animals chewing their cud and having split hooves, is all about keeping the body healthy. He believes that the meat of the forbidden animals, birds, and fish is unwholesome and indigestible, and that the kosher animals are the ones that are best and are most healthiest for the physical makeup of a human being. And that's how he looks at these specific kosher laws, chewing its cud and having split hooves. This medical approach to the Bible, which was very popular in the medieval period, was subject to a withering and very convincing, I think, critique by the great Spanish scholar, statesman, rabbi, Don Yitzhak, or Isaac Abarbanel. And he explains, commenting on Maimonides and Nachmanides, is that the approach of saying that kosher, and specifically the laws of which animals are kosher, are about the healthy, being healthier foods, he argues threefold. He gives three different arguments against that concept. But the first is one that I want to point out, and I think it tells us a lot about what the Torah is in general. It would turn the Bible into a medical textbook, he says. One more concern with cleanliness than godliness. And this is not the way of the Word of God, nor its ultimate intent. Meaning, of course, the Torah takes very seriously the health and the health of every single human being. But that's not the point of the Torah. The Torah left that to medical professionals. And what the Torah is our lessons, our spiritual lessons, our lessons that make our lives more meaningful. So I think that's a very important point. The second important point, counter argument or argument against kosher, specifically the laws of our animals being because of health reasons, is that all you have to do is take a look at the traditional staples of Ashkenazic Jewish cuisine, which include chopped liver, gribanis, our fried chicken skins, cholent, which we have this Shabbat, which is a incredibly fatty and oily stew that cooks for 24 hours, and many other of our wonderful and delicious delicacies. But it's hard to say that kosher food is the healthiest of foods. Rather, it's for the heart, maybe of the most difficult to understand diets. But that's so. And also, what I find interesting about the medical reasoning for kosher is that if you ask a lot of people about the laws of kosher that don't necessarily keep kosher, or even they do, they would say, "Oh, it was basically God's medical reasons from thousands of years ago, and of course it's outdated." So instead of saying that it is for medical reasons and outdated, I much prefer to say that it had nothing to do with medical reasons, and therefore there's nothing to be outdated. And we have many, many great scholars, important Jewish scholars that would agree with that, as I pointed out, the words of Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Just a couple of interesting little insights. When it comes to ruminants, right, these animals that chew their cud, I think, you know, there are some lessons that they can teach us. Have you ever seen a cow? It takes forever to chew on the grass that it's eating, and then it comes back up, and then they chew some more, and comes back up, and then they chew some more. And that you know, obviously there's that root to ruminate, the word to ruminate, to be thoughtful, to think through something. So, you know, I think that as we eat that and we, you know, and we focus on that for just a moment, you know, it could teach us lessons about becoming more thoughtful, people that reflect more before we do, maintaining more control over our actions. So there's something interesting there. When it comes to split hooves, I think, you know, they need to be completely split hooves, teaching us that there is objective good and bad. There's black and white, right and wrong, which is very important in this age of moral relativism. But there are two concepts I really want to share. And I want to thank two different sources for these two different concepts. The first one is Aleph Beta. Aleph Beta is a wonderful website that teaches the Torah and deep ideas about the Torah through cartoons. Really fantastic. And the second one is Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, one of the most important Jewish thinkers today. The first one, idea is based off an idea I got from some of the scholars at Aleph Beta. And it asks the question, it points out something very interesting at the beginning of the Torah. We generally take for granted that we can eat meat, but it's actually not so simple. Way back in Genesis, the beginning of the Torah, God was very clear what was permitted for mankind to eat. God says, I give you every plant upon the earth, and every fruit tree is yours for food. In other words, in the ideal world, humanity is strictly vegetarian. After the flood of Noah that wipes out the entire world except for Noah and his family, and they start again, God says to Noah, all living animals shall be yours to eat. All of a sudden, we no longer have to be vegetarians. And why is that? God said in God's heart, I will no longer curse the ground because of mankind's sins, because the inclination of mankind's heart are evil from his youth. In other words, it seems that in this post-flood world, the world is much less sensitive to the evil of mankind. Or to say it differently, God is much more accepting of humanity's shortcomings. So, and it gives in to the foibles of human beings. So let's talk about this for just a moment. Originally, in humanity's ideal state, the creation of Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden, mankind only ate vegetation. Why would it be important for mankind to only eat vegetation? So there are many different, you know, you can think of different reasons for this, but I think one that is actually shared with us by some of the early Jewish scholars is that the success of a farmer is so deeply dependent on that which he cannot control. Rain, climate, soil, terrain. Of anybody in the world, it's easiest for a farmer to recognize that it's his food that comes from God. So eating vegetation, eating only vegetation, would connect us in a very deep way to the land and therefore remind us that everything that we have, everything in the world, everything that sustains us, everything that we are, comes from God. When we eat vegetation, we are getting our sustenance from the land. When we eat meat, it still may be from the land because that's what animals eat, but it's one step removed. We're getting our sustenance from the animal who gets its sustenance from the land. So perhaps this is what happened. Before the flood, God said mankind is superior over the living world and gave us dominion over animals. Mankind could use animals for farming and plowing. Human beings could use animals for farming and plowing. But with that type of dominion, humankind could easily fall into under this illusion of being in control. That humanity, that human beings are the masters. So God included this fail-safe. You can assert dominance over animals, but you're not allowed to eat them because you're not in control. And the ability to take away the life of an animal would play precisely into the illusion that mankind or human beings are the master of life. Instead, both animals and human beings would eat from the very same source, which is natural vegetation. And therefore, we would constantly be reminded that regardless of our own superiority, perhaps, or our dominion over animals, and that's a whole nother discussion, the whole world is God's and everything comes from God. In the post-flood world, God allows human beings to play into its natural desires to eat meat, to assert dominance over animals, not just by working them, but also by eating them. But what about this previous concern? How can human beings ensure that we will not be deluded into forgetting that God is in control, to thinking that humanity, the human being, is in control? So here comes the laws of keeping kosher. You're allowed to eat meat, but it's not a blank check. God gives us these laws and restricts and gives us parameters into how we're allowed to eat meat. And what these parameters do is allows us to eat meat by never forgetting forgetting that it is not us that is in control. Now, how does kosher do that? Well, what is the first law that Noah is told after being told that he can eat meat? The first law is you're not allowed to eat the flesh of an animal with its blood in it. Why not? Well, the verse in Vayikra in Leviticus tells us, for the life force of a creature is its blood. In other words, blood is the most powerful reminder of life, of the life of every living being. And when we're not allowed to eat that. We're not allowed to eat blood because that would allow us to feel like we are too much in control because we are eating the life force, the very life of another living being. Furthermore, not only are we not allowed to eat the blood, but we actually have to cover the blood. When we kill an animal, we have to pour the blood on the ground or allow the blood to fall on the ground and then cover it with dirt. Why do we cover it with dirt? It allows us to become more sensitive. When we return the animal's blood to the earth, it reminds us that as dominant and as powerful as we are, we recognize that it's the animal's life that comes from the land, that comes from the earth. And ultimately, therefore, it's our land, it's our lives that come from the earth. And then we will not forget our dependence on God, and we will not come under this illusion that it is us that is in control. And then we get to the later laws of kashrut, the ones that we learn about in Leviticus, where we learn about how an animal is only kosher if it chews its cud and has split hooves. Why is that important? So let's just talk for just a moment. Chewing its cud. Why do ruminants, why do animals that chew its cud need to break down their food so rigorously? So it actually has to do with what they eat. This is a bit of an evolutionary discussion, but basically the ruminants, the ones that chew their cuds, they're herbivores, they're plant eaters, but a very specific type of herbivore. They don't eat seeds, grains, and nuts. They primarily eat raw leaves and grasses, which are very cellulose-rich plants that are extremely difficult to digest. Right? Human beings actually don't even have the proper enzymes to digest them. But that's what ruminants do. That's what those that chew their cuds do. Their four-compartment stomachs and cud chewings are all done to break down and digest their grassy and leafy food. So that's as far as chewing its cud goes. They chew their cud in order to digest because they eat very specific foods, which are grass and herbs and leafy substances. And then let's talk about the split hooves. Why does an animal have split hooves? So what is a split hoof? Well, a hoof is the tip of an animal's toe that's covered by a thick, hard keratin coat. And it's that heavy-duty hoof that allows an animal to stand and travel for long periods of time. Well, a split hoof goes one step further. They provide extra traction when running or jumping on different types of terrain, including flatlands and grassy pastures. Hooves, all hooved animals, besides for a pig, are herbivores. They only eat plants, or they only eat vegetation. And hooves allow them to graze in pastures for long periods of time, but especially for those grass and leaf eaters who are grazing in wide open fields, that makes them very vulnerable to predators. So split hooves give animals the dexterity to escape capture across any terrain. So both of these traits, chewing its cud and having split hooves, speaks directly to one commonality between them. And what is that commonality? They are grass and leaf eating vegetarians. And in fact, the Talmud tells us this. The Talmud tells us that there's another way to determine if an animal is kosher. And that is, does it have upper incisors, right? Those are types of teeth. And if it does not have those types of teeth, then you know it's kosher. Why? Because upper incisors are very sharp teeth that are used to rip through tough materials like nuts or animal flesh. If an animal doesn't have those, it means it doesn't need those. Why wouldn't it need those? Because what it eats is leaves and grass. It leaves the leafy types of vegetation. So they're basically coming to the same conclusion that there's something very specific about the kosher animal that is defined by chewing cud and having split hoof, and that is they are leaf and grass eating animals. That's what they do. So now why is that important? Why is it important for them to be grass eating vegetarians? Well, now we can make a lot of sense of this. Because by eating vegetation in its rawest form, these animals remain deeply connected to the land. In other words, they remain completely connected to the source, to God. They're really the last relics of the world's ideal state. So God is telling us that even when we consume meat, even when we assert our dominance over animals, we have to do it in a way that keeps us connected and sensitizes us in the best way possible to the ultimate source. It's not ideal to eat animals, and we might forget that as far up as we go along. So what we're here to remember, and we need to remember, is that all of our nourishment really comes from the land. We're all dependent on God for our sustenance, right? The rules of kashrut, of kosher, they're not meant to make our lives more difficult. They're meant to make our lives more meaningful. They're meant to allow us to remain sensitive, spiritually sensitive, meaningfully sensitive, and connected to the land, and therefore connected to God. So the animals we eat perfectly reflect all of this as we think about the source of their nourishment. And as we only eat these specific types of animals, we imbue ourselves with the humility and faith of the farmer, raising our eyes to the heaven, knowing that it is God who provides for us. And I think that this is a very special idea. Of course, it points to something very important, that when we engage in Jewish ritual, there's deep meaning behind Jewish ritual. And Judaism is a sustained meditation on living the most meaningful life possible, which means that when we go through these rituals, we have to be focused. We have to be present and think through these things in order for us to be able to feel the maximum power and the maximum impact of these things. Of course, they are powerful even if we're not constantly meditating on the importance, on the meaning behind each of the rituals that we go through. But the meaning is there. It's just up to us to connect to it. So I think that's an interesting thing. Another idea that I very recently learned, and I want to thank Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik for this, is the following concept. The Torah gives no reason for the specific details of kashrut, the specific details of which animals are kosher, chewing its cud and having split hooves, for why is that specifically important. And what perhaps we want to suggest is that the Torah does not elaborate on why these distinctions are made on purpose. Because it's more interested in us differentiating between different types of animals, choosing one type of animal to eat and one not, than understanding why we have to choose between one animal, or why are we specifically choosing one animal versus another. The only thing the Torah tells us when describing to us in Leviticus, in Vayikra, the purpose of kashrut is that, and I'm going to read it to you directly and then try to explain it for a moment, is that, "For I, the Lord, am holy and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine." In other words, kashrut is supposed to allow us to reflect on this idea that being Jewish means being different, means being distinct, and the chosen nature of the Jewish people. Before I go any further, I want to mention that the Jewish people being a chosen nation is not a discussion for today. We will discuss it in a further podcast, but it can come off as a, you know, with a bit of a racist overtone that we're chosen, we're the chosen people, an elitist overtone. The reality is that once you understand what we are chosen for, you will no longer believe that to be an elitist concept. But certainly, as Jews, we believe that we are different, no different than other human beings, but we are chosen for something specific. Let's go with that. And that's what the Torah tells us. The Torah tells us that kosher is there to remind us of our uniqueness, of our distinctiveness, of our chosenness. Now, at first glance, you could understand this to mean that, yeah, obviously, if we have a different diet, and we have dietary restrictions that the rest of the world doesn't have, then it will be very difficult for us to assimilate. Because if you can't eat together with other people, then it's very hard to assimilate into their culture, and we will by definition, maintain our own unique identities. And in fact, kosher has worked very well throughout the throughout many years of Jewish history in differentiating between the Jew and the one that is not Jewish and the non-Jew. But if you look at the words of Leviticus, the words that are used, it seems to tell us that within the laws, within the specific details of keeping kosher, there should be a reminder to the Jew of our chosenness. Not just that kosher protects against the Jewish people assimilating, but rather reminds us every day as we eat kosher and don't eat non-kosher, it reminds us every day of our uniqueness, of our distinctiveness. And what's fascinating, in other words, as we are choosing between one type of animal and another, that will remind us of this idea of God choosing between different nations and there being a distinct nature to being somebody that is Jewish. Interestingly, there is an ancient text that grasped this meaning, this understanding of what kashrut is all about. And then it argued against its observance. And what was that? It's the book of Acts in the New Testament. In the early history of the Christian church, they were divided over the following question. Must all who wish to become Christian convert to Judaism first and abide by the laws of the Torah? Or did the death and resurrection of Jesus make being Jewish no longer important? Peter is depicted in the book of Acts as receiving a response to this question, the Apostle Peter, in a vision in which he is instructed by God to partake in non-kosher food. They're on a journey. Peter went up on a housetop to pray. He became hungry, and while food was being prepared, he fell into some sort of trance, saw the heaven open, something descending. All different types of animals were now descending, non-kosher animals, and a voice came up to him and said, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat these animals." And Peter said, "No, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is not kosher." And the voice came to him again and said, "What God has made, has cleansed, you must not call not kosher." This happened three times, and Peter comes to understand this vision as declaring that God's covenant with one specific person, with one specific nation, with the Jewish people, is no longer. And at that point, Peter opens his mouth and says, "I now know that God shows no chosenness. God does not choose." And at that point in time, while Peter is talking about how he sees from the fact that he's being told to no longer keep kosher, how that's no longer important, that we then therefore see that God no longer has a chosen nation, and therefore there is no need to convert to Judaism in order to become a good Christian. That is the story there. In other words, what Peter is telling us, he's telling us that kosher is no longer important, because what is the message of kosher? The message of kosher is that just as God chooses the Jewish people as a nation, chooses us for something specific as a nation, we are reminded of that as we choose between the different animals. As kosher is no longer important, the message of kosher is no longer important, and the concept of chosenness, the concept of distinctiveness as a nation, is no longer a reality. So Christianity understood this. So Peter understood what the message of the Torah was when it came to kosher. He used it for the exact opposite that of the message that Jews are supposed to eternalize throughout our entire history. And it's no accident, therefore, that one of the early acts of Christianity was to abolish the kosher laws. Historians claim that the purpose was to ease the process of converting those to Christianity, people that were not Christian to Christianity, right? Oh, if I don't have to keep kosher, it's much easier to be a Christian. But at best, that's a partial truth. Really, what we're seeing very clearly from the New Testament is that abolishing the kosher laws also abolishes the distinction between the Jew and the non-Jew. And that's exactly what the founders of Christianity wanted to accomplish. And it's exactly what the Torah wanted to accomplish by in turn having the laws of kosher, reminding us every single time we eat meat that we are distinct as a people, that the Jewish people are distinct chosen for something specific, and we have a unique mission in this world. But now it also makes sense why we're not, it's not explained to us why one animal is chosen over the other. Because what we're to be reminded of, as we're supposed to be remembering our chosenness every time we eat kosher meat, what we're supposed to be remembered of is our chosenness. But being reminded of our chosenness can lead us to arrogance. We are chosen. We are greater than everybody. In order to make sure that instead we are humbled, when we think about, we are humbled with the sense of mission and responsibility that being a chosen nation gives us. In order to remind us to remain humble, we are not given an understanding. We are not going to be able to understand why one animal is chosen, why one animal is not. To remind us, we are not God. We are not the divine just because we are chosen for a specific purpose, for a specific mission. And that, perhaps, is the idea behind the laws of kosher. We are to remember that we are chosen, but we are never to use that as a way, as thinking that we are better than anybody because of that. And we're reminded that by purposely, specifically being told, you are not going to understand. I'm not going to give the reasons for these laws because you are still human beings. You are not God, and you must remain humble. And I think it's important. It's very important that we Jews remember this all the time, because there's a very interesting story, and I'm going to share it quickly, and then we're going to finish off this up this class. But the story goes like this. Shlomo Carlebach, who was a singing rabbi, he would go all over the world singing his famous songs. He became quite a well-known folk singer as well. And he reflects on his visits to American campuses in the 60s or in the 70s. And he reflects that, I ask students what they are. If someone gets up and says, I'm Catholic, I know that's a Catholic. If someone says, I'm a Protestant, I know that's a Protestant. If someone gets up and says, I'm just a human being, I know that's a Jew. Because, unfortunately, that's what happens sometimes with Jews. We tend to forget our uniqueness as a people. We tend to forget that that Jews also are distinct as a people. And the laws of kashrut are there to remind us. The laws of kashrut are not just a cultural curiosity, but a reminder to each and every Jew of all that his people has been, of all that her people has been, and of all that God has called us to be by being chosen for a mission. Also important to remember, another very important idea to remember, is that some of the mitzvot we can understand, and some of the mitzvot we cannot understand. And the mitzvot that we cannot understand completely are called chukim, laws that were given to us by an infinite mind, by the mind of God, by the infinite, and a finite being cannot be expected to comprehend the entirety of an infinite intellect, the mind of God. And kosher also can be understood in this way as well. We may have all of these different ideas as to why to keep kosher and the meaning behind each of these different kosher laws and kosher in general, but ultimately this can be labeled as a chok, one of those laws that the finite cannot completely understand. And why do we do it? We do it out of love, no different than the requests of a beloved that we may not understand, but we do because we love and we have faith. So too, the laws of kashrut, we are asked to follow them purely as an expression of our love, which means that daily the observance of kashrut calls us back to a personal relationship with God. I want to finish off with one more concept, and that is kosher certification. Why do foods require kosher certification? You go to the supermarket, you want to buy a processed food and you want to keep kosher, you need to find a kosher label, which is called a hechsher in Hebrew, something that tells you that this is kosher. But why is that necessary? As long as you know that the ingredients are kosher, you should be able to buy it. Like cereal and potato chips, like what could possibly be not kosher? They're not made from meat, they're not made from birds, they're not made from fish, they're not made from insects. What could possibly be unkosher? They're not made as meat and dairy together. So what could be unkosher? So let me tell you an example, a cereal. A cereal may be non-kosher because it has raisins in it. And those raisins may be coated with a non-kosher animal-based glycerin. Or potato chips, they could be non-kosher if the vegetable oil that was used to fry them was used in a fryer that has been pasteurized and deodorized on equipment that was used for meat fat production. In fact, equipment used for hot production of non-kosher products may not be used for kosher production without first kosherizing those utensils. So all in all to say is that the intricacies of modern-day food technology makes it virtually impossible for anyone but an expert in the field to know whether a processed food is free of any trace of non-kosher ingredients. So all processed foods and eating establishments require certification by a reliable rabbi or kashrut supervising agency. Last two words to know, mashkiach, which is a supervisor, Hebrew for supervisor, somebody that's appointed to ensure that the food produced at a commercial establishment is kosher, and hechsher in Hebrew, which is a kosher certification, which is a symbol denoting that a given product is certified kosher. Just to finish off, we are coming to the end of the hour. I just gave a lot of details, a lot of ideas as to why keep kosher, as to what the meaning behind keeping kosher is. We spoke about the holistic makeup of a human being. We spoke about discipline. We spoke about the treating animals in a humane way. We spoke about reminding ourselves on a consistent basis of our chosenness and how the Christian church recognized that that is the purpose of kosher. We spoke about how kosher keeps us from assimilating, although of course it's also so important for the Jewish people to become part of greater society and to gain and be part of that modern conversation, but as well we also have to insulate ourselves from assimilation. We also spoke about how kosher is this incredible reminder that that physicality, the physical in Judaism, is not something to be spurned, but instead it's a vehicle for huge meaning, for living even more meaningful lives. And we also spoke about how there are some things that we don't understand, because the finite being cannot be expected to understand the thinking of the infinite in a completely in a fulsome way, and kashrut is one of those types of laws that we keep out of faith, that we keep out of love, that is a daily relationship builder between the human being and the divine. So that's a little bit about kosher. Thanks so much for listening.